The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The World Cup is nearly here, so today we'll focus on England and ask the burning questions. Dyer or Henderson, Rose or Young, Fortnite or Love Island. We'll take a look at their opponents too, Tunisia, Panama and Belgium. We'll touch on some of the other big football stories that have happened since we last sat in this room after the Champions League final. It's like the World Cup preview plus other bits of football. Monday Football Weekly, brought to you by The Guardian. Anirudh writes, did you miss Barry Glendening during the other World Cup preview shows? I did massively, but the fact that we're going to spend pretty much every day in this room together meant I should probably have taken the silence and solace of that quite well. Barry, it's nice to see you.
And it's always a pleasure to see you.
Are you, like me, going to go booze-free for the World Cup to keep our minds sharp?
I don't think I'm going to have much choice because I'm going to be stuck in here with you every night. And I'd say we'll be here till long after closing time, so...
People would kill for this job, Barry.
I'm not complaining.
Sounds like you're complaining. Hey, Dom, you're following England every step of the way.
Yeah, I am. All five steps, I hope.
Are you excited?
Yeah, I'm actually quite looking forward to seeing them play in this one. There's a bit of optimism around the place.
I didn't give you your full name, Dom. Dom Fifield is to my right. And on the phone, packing for Russia, is Barney Ronay. Barney, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm wonderful, thanks. Are you packing for Russia right now?
Yeah, no, I haven't actually done it yet. I need to do that now. I'm a bit anxious about the whole thing, to be honest. It's a slightly unusual experience going to Russia. You're so used to going to places where you feel it's all open arms and a huge welcome. But I'm sure it will be like that. But right now, it's hard to feel entirely 100% positive.
Have they sent you and Dom on sort of... defense training courses and things like
that? Yeah, we had a street fighting class for a few weeks.
Sorry about
the
that.
Guardian. Dom was incredible, I have to say. Didn't need it at all.
Like the turtles, will one of you have nunchucks and one will have a pugil stick?
Yeah, I'm really good at running away. That's my skill.
Now, how enthusiastic, Dom, are you about the England squad? Because I've heard nothing but positive. I mean, I'm naturally a very positive person. I always think we're going to win the tournament. But now other people don't think we're going to win, but seem to think that it's all nice and happy.
I'm positive. I like what Southgate has done in terms of putting a plan down. There's very clear strategy, both in terms of tactics. There's a lot of pace in the squad, a lot of youth. I think he's already demonstrated that he won't shirk from the difficult decisions in his selection over Jack Wilshere, Joe Hart, even going back to Wayne Rooney. And I don't think he'll be, you know, playing players for the sake of it, for reputation's sake. He will pick the team that he feels fits best into his system. And if that means leaving out, you know, players that have got them there to the World Cup, he will. I'm optimistic at the moment. I'm conscious also, though, that we've been cautiously optimistic going into major finals recently, and weird things happen with England at tournaments. Sort of the madness descends upon the camp. So there's a bit of caution there. Let's see how it goes. But everything so far has been very positive.
Barney, cautiously optimistic?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, what Dolman said is correct. I do want to just float an idea. I was thinking the other day, and this is a ridiculous thing to say, I'm aware of that, but I mean, England could win the World Cup. I mean, I've never really said that before or thought it before, because I've always felt that there are games it was impossible for them to win because of the way they played. But just thinking about, like Dom was saying, the way Southgate plays, for example, they could never keep the ball. You go to a tournament and it was hot and there were teams that were expert at keeping the ball, and it was just impossible to beat somebody who just wouldn't let you play against them. He's like 2002 against Brazil, where they had a man advantage, but just couldn't get the ball, couldn't keep it. And I had this sort of feeling that, well, actually, England can do that now. They play the right way for tournament football. I think they're just, if all the players were 20% better, then you'd actually be quite optimistic about them. But there's no, you think of the way Portugal won the Euros. Obviously, we don't have a Cristiano Ronaldo, but that kind of template for how to play in tournaments, they can actually follow now. And I feel more optimistic about how well they might do than I did when they had better players, simply because they're approaching it in an interesting way.
Barry, you almost fell off your chair when you heard Barney saying we could win the World Cup.
Yeah, I'm surprised, to be honest.
Well, no, I don't think they will. But it's not physically impossible for them to win the World Cup. I mean, what would you have to do? They'll get through the group. They've got to get through the group. I mean, they've got to finish above Tunisia and Panama, no offence to them. And then I can see them scraping a sort of slightly fluky last 16 win against someone where they keep a clean sheet and get through. And then there are three games against good teams. And in the past, I always felt they couldn't really beat good teams because they wouldn't have the ball enough, and they just couldn't. They were too panicky in possession. It was literally impossible to beat Spain. But it's not impossible. Obviously, they're not as good as those teams by some distance, but they do at least have, like Dom says, they have a plan. And that's something new. I don't remember having a plan since Euro 96, probably. So that is interesting. I'm really interested to see if they can stick to it and if it works.
Well, I don't necessarily agree they have to get through the group, because we've all seen how they can come unstuck in the most incredible ways in the past. But even if they do, and they probably will get through the group, I can see them certainly scraping through one knockout round, but I can't see them winning three tough games in a row. I just find that, I think that would be a step beyond them. I mean, I think a quarterfinal exit would be about par for England. Anything else would be absolutely spectacular, but
I take Barney's point, actually, and those friendlies were, there was lots of positivities to come out of those friendlies, not entirely, but the wins against Nigeria and Costa Rica. I wondered, Dom, if the second friendly would have changed Southgate's mind on team selection.
I think there were a couple of issues in that second game that gave him something to think about. I thought Loftus-Cheek was outstanding in midfield. I think had Ruben Loftus-Cheek not had the injury from late December through to mid-March and missed the friendlies in March, I think he would have been nailed on to start the first game against Tunisia. Now he's sort of competing realistically with Jesse Lingard, I guess, and Lingard is a Southgate favourite, so it may be that he starts the tournament on the bench, but I think he will have an influence in the tournament. He's another one that keeps possession really, really well. He didn't give the ball away at all at Leeds. I think at left back, left wing back rather, Danny Rose made his case, started off well. I wonder whether a lack of fitness might just cost him a start at the first game, so he might start with Ashley Young in that first match in Volgograd. And obviously Rashford was outstanding against a pretty poor Costa Rica team. It looked as if they were suffering from the travel more than anything. But again, I just don't think Southgate will not pick Raheem Sterling against Tunisia.
That'd be the choice. Could you play Sterling, Kane and Rashford instead of Lingard, say?
I'd be very surprised at that. He has got two options with his formation. He's played 3-5-2 most recently, which is sort of two progressive number eights and a sitting midfielder that will be a choice between Dier and Henderson, I imagine, although Delph actually did well in that role in the second half against Costa Rica. But in that system, I don't think you can fit in Sterling, Lingard and Kane. So the alternative is what I suspect they penciled in for the Belgium game, which is 3-4-3, when you have the three up top, and maybe there then it's a case of playing Rashford on the left and Sterling on the right, but then you're getting rid of Dele Alli, arguably, which, you know, wasn't unfeasible in March when he only played 21 minutes of those two friendlies in March, but I thought he was excellent against Nigeria and really just restated the fact that he is a quality player and links up so well with Harry Kane. So why would you not use him?
Barney, are you a Dier or a Henderson man?
It's an interesting choice, isn't it? I can see that Jordan Henderson's a really good footballer, and lots of managers who he's managed really, really like him. But I don't really want him to be a first choice pick for England. I'd probably go with Dier, even though I have sort of reservations about him as well. I think probably that's one area of the team that's not as strong as it could be. I agree with Dom about Loftus-Cheek as well. It's he's a really interesting player because you don't really know how good he is or how good he could be, but he offers that thing that England really need in a way of he uses the ball really nicely and he passes well, which neither of those two central midfielders do. And I think it's a real shame he's injured. I completely agree. I think he could have really been a key ingredient in that team and lessened the burden on the central midfield to be able to do anything other than plug a hole and run a lot, which is sort of what those two do.
Kyle Walker will start in the three, but the other two aren't nailed down, are they? John Stones seems to be, but when Cahill played well against Nigeria, people thought, well, actually, you could play Cahill in the middle and Maguire on the left and Stones might drop out. I don't know what you think, Don.
I watched Gary Cahill at Chelsea last season and there were periods where he struggled badly when he was deputising for Andreas Christensen in the middle of a back three. I'd prefer him on the left. I do worry a bit about those balls slid between Young or Rose and Cahill down that channel. I think he's not going to be the quickest on the turn. But bear in mind that he's the only player in that squad with 40 caps, so they're over 40 caps. He's got 58, 59 now. So having him around is beneficial, I think, just to add a bit of experience to a youthful group. I think had Harry Maguire been fully fit, and I don't think he is at the moment, I think he would have started on the left of the three. But as it is, I imagine that Kaye will go the first game.
Barney?
Well, I have to say, I mean, I agree. I don't really get the experience idea particularly. I know we like to think like that, and I'm sure it is important. But, I mean, looking at both Cahill and Henderson, do you remember the Uruguay game in Sao Paulo? I think England weren't a bad. They didn't play that badly that day. They lost because of some individual mistakes in marking and closing down in midfield. And Henderson and Cahill were both involved in that. And if you'd said 4 years from now, certainly Cahill would have gone slightly backwards in his club career and would still be first choice for England. You'd think, oh my God, what's happened to English football? You know, you'd think there'd be no real progress. And Henderson too. I mean, if you go down that road, you'll find probably half the starting 11 would have played in the Iceland game as well. But I mean, that was a bit of a one-off. Everybody just froze that day. But I agree. If Maguire was fit, I quite like the look of him in the previous friendlies. And Cahill looks certainly vulnerable to someone like Eden Hazard running down the side of the defence.
Barry, did you like the look of the atmosphere in Leeds?
Yeah, full house. Everyone seemed to have a lovely time. I'm firmly believe that England games should move around the country and play in different stadiums. And we all know why they aren't, because, you know, Wembley is there, it has to be paid for, and so, but, you know, play them in Leeds, play them wherever.
Agreed, Dom?
Yeah, I thought it was fantastic atmosphere. It was helped by the fact there were five Yorkshiremen starting, I think. But it was, you could just see how
a Monty Python sketch.
But there was post-match in the mix zone. A load of kids were just hanging around, and they were absolutely thrilled to be so close to I was going to say the press pack, but no, to England players. And I mean, it was a great scene. It was a lovely scene, and it just shows that the England team should be touring the country. It should be going out and playing, in the biggest stadia around the country.
Barney, since we did the last pod, which was just after the Champions League final, Raheem Sterling has dominated a lot of the front pages as well as the back pages. What have you made of his treatment?
Well, I think my sort of views on that are fairly well known. I don't understand it. I think I do understand it, but I don't agree with it. It's almost like a reflex action. We're so used to the idea that when there's a tournament, we must in some way assail and assault and attack our best or most visible player. I mean, it happened for often, you know, for good reason to Wayne Rooney and to anybody who happened to have a slightly fancy haircut or to look like a foppish footballer who you could attack. I think the Sterling thing was just complete nonsense. I mean, obviously he was late for training, to join up with training, and that's a team issue, and I'm sure Gareth Southgate would have liked to be able to deal with that without any surrounding pressure. The stuff about his tattoos is just absolute nonsense. I know a lot of people out there will say this is a kind of race issue that a lot of newspapers struggle to deal still with the idea of a wealthy, successful young black footballer and attack them using those kind of signifiers. I mean, I would say Wayne Rooney got similar disparaging, very sneery treatment based on the fact that he was portrayed as kind of dim, stupid Wayne. which are more of a class issue. Certainly, there's an urge to turn these things into stories. It doesn't come from the sports pages. I know people are probably tired of hearing this, but most sports reporters on the papers who have been reporting that stuff will be mortified by that. It comes from the news pages, where they think they can turn these footballers into sort of casualties of the usual treatment. But I thought it was pretty appalling. I think Raheem Sterling's a really excellent professional and excellent player we should be proud of. And who was even racially assaulted before a Man City game last year. I think it was, it may have been the Liverpool game, went out and played 90 minutes. And we only found about it after. He's an incredibly tough and likable person, I find. And I'm sort of ashamed to be part of a profession that treats him in that way.
There was some booing, Dom. The Nigerian fans booed Dele Alli at Wembley, and the Leeds fans booed the Manchester United players at Elland Road. Should we read any? We don't have to read that much into those things.
No, the Elland Road, it was all very playful. It was all pantomime stuff. They were cheering Marcus Rashford's goal to the rafters, and they didn't have a problem with it then. So, and the players, likewise, as they were leaving the ground, they were signing autographs with the locals as well. So it was nothing. The Nigeria one was interesting and maybe caught us a bit on the hop. But I guess he's got Nigerian parentage, and they took offence to that.
Will you be staying near the team in the same hotel?
No, not in the same hotel. But I'm very close and about 100 yards away in another hotel. And I've just read this morning that there is some kind of horrendous disease-carrying tick that has been swarming in the area. So off to buy the DEET after this, I guess.
Yeah, you need some bug spray. And Barney, the players, I was listening to the players and that, they all sat and had that sort of speed dating session, which seemed to go very well. And they all were very happy to be interviewed by everybody. The debate was whether they were going to be playing Fortnite or watching Love Island. And I just wonder which of those you'll be downloading onto your iPad for the quiet moments of your trip to Russia.
Well, my children play Fortnite, which seems to me somebody somewhere has come up with an incredibly simple game and presumably made millions and millions of pounds out of it. I don't really get it. I'm au fait with Fortnite. You won't catch me out of that. I can floss. I Love Island, I'm afraid, I don't really understand. I don't know how you win Love Island. What's the goal of the game? I don't get it.
Last couple standing, Barney.
But how do you get eliminated? What do you do wrong?
You fail to find the partner at the end of each week. You're left like a gooseberry.
Oh, but doesn't that mean there are simply relationships of convenience?
Oh, yes.
Well, that's a very cynical view of what others would say is a beautiful journey to true love, Barney.
Well, I also kept reading newspaper articles that compared it to going to Oxbridge, that more people had applied to Love Island than to apply to go to Oxbridge. So I kind of watched it to see what the similarities were, and presumably there was a reason for making this comparison, but I couldn't sort of weigh the two up, and I couldn't see where they were similar.
Maybe you went to a different part of Oxbridge, Barney.
This only didn't look very familiar to me.
Barney, quick question. Do you have to go now, or can we have you in part two where we talk about Tunisia, Belgium and Panama?
I sort of have to go, to be honest. Isn't it a bit artificial being on the phone, because you have to kind of tell me who you're talking to and stuff?
Well, yeah, I mean, ideally we'd be looking into your eyes, but you've been marvellous.
I know what happens as well. While the person on the phone is speaking, everyone else rolls their eyes. cut. Oh, he's going on a bit. I know that. I've seen it. I've done it.
Max is actually wearing a Love Island t-shirt.
To be fair, I was really listening and concentrating, Barney.
Yeah, I bet you were.
While you're on. But thanks for your time, Barney. We'll let you go.
All right, thank you.
Enjoy Russia, and we will phone you up every evening.
Yeah, no, I am available.
And we promise when we speak to you, we won't roll our eyes while you're talking.
Thanks. You're rolling them now, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. Barney Ronnie there, going, dragging on, droning on like he always does. Have we hung up? Oh, no, he's still there. Lovely to speak to you. lovely to speak to Barney Ronnie. That'll do for part one. In part two, Barry, Dom and I will look at the other teams in England's group. Welcome to part two of Guardian Football Weekly, Group G special. On the 12th of July, Barry, we're doing a live show ahead of the World Cup final between Uruguay and Portugal. We'll be getting the mood of the nation. You, me, Philippe Auclair and Ellis James.
I'm looking forward to that.
And I was thinking about, as a panel, taking myself out of that. What a beautiful selection of voices.
Well, you have a French accent, my soft Irish brogue, and Ellis's incomprehensible Welsh needle-nardle-newing.
Either way, you can come, and if you're not enjoying what we're saying, just close your eyes and listen to the noises. That's the Emmanuel Centre in London, 12th of July. Tickets are available. England's opponents, should we start with Belgium? Dom, they've got some incredible players. They also have Roberto Martinez. And I don't mean to sort of sound derogatory about that, but you feel the players are better than the manager.
Yeah, definitely. They're in a similar sort of situation to England in that they are enduring their golden generation, but time is ticking down on that golden generation to make its mark and prove its pedigree. And if you talk to a lot of Belgian journalists, they're suggesting that Martinez may hold them back in actually achieving that, which, well, we'll see. I mean, he's already made some controversial decisions. Nainggolan's omission was greeted with a lot of wailing disbelief, I think, in Belgium. There are issues around that. We had the whole of Mattressgate in the build-up, which was interesting. And
explain Mattressgate.
Well, that's what I understood it. He hadn't announced his final 23. He had I think 28 players there. And then on the day or 2 days before he was meant to announce the 23, 23 mattresses with the names of respective players turned up at the team hotel and were photographed by photographers. And people deduced the final 23-man squad from that. It wasn't right in as much as I think two of the names weren't right, possibly three. Christian Benteke missed out in the end and he had a mattress. So presumably Benteke now has brought his mattress back to South London and is going to enjoy the World Cup whilst not getting any back trouble, which is good news for Palace. Excellent.
I think Barry, at one point, I'm sure a couple of months ago, and I might be wrong, you said Christian Benteke might be the top scorer at the World Cup.
Yeah, that I did say that, and it seems quite unlikely to happen.
It does, doesn't it?
I said that Leroy Sané would tear up the World Cup as well, so he's done great there.
But you do think a team that can start with De Bruyne and Hazard just should be fantastic, especially because they have, even if Kompany isn't fit, I know they play three at the back, don't they? Play Alderweireld, Kompany and Vertonghen. Well, that's tough if Kompany's not fit, but they have some great... They should be able to go a long way.
They should be, and they might, but people seem to be very down on their chances, and people seem to have little or no faith in Roberto Martinez. I was earwigging on an editorial meeting in the office this morning, and I think I'm correct in saying there's an interview with Roberto Martinez going to be in The Guardian in the next day or two, and the vibe from that seems to be that he's sounds very much like a man under incredible pressure and possibly isn't handling that pressure particularly well. I think the only reason he got that job is because he was cheap. The Belgian Football Federation.
There's nothing wrong with that.
But, you know...
Were Belgium desperate as well?
He was by no means, I think, their first choice, and other options prove more too expensive. But, you know, he has been stressing the need for, you know, there's no point in having all these talented individuals if they can't play as a team. And I can see no reason why they can't do well, but they do seem to have problems in defence. But having said that, I don't think they've conceded in any of their last four friendlies. I know they're only friendlies, but that has to be a positive sign.
They've got a final friendly tonight against Costa Rica in Brussels. Producer Jonathan says they may be vulnerable at left back because Yannick Carrasco is not a defender, and that's so Trippier will have a field day, and that's how we'll beat them.
I've spoken to a couple of people about England's prospects against them, and they've all said that might be the game where you take the really brave decision and actually leave out Harry Kane and play Jamie Vardy and get him running because presumably England, that of the three games, well, I know England will have most of the ball in the first two games, but they may struggle to retain possession in quite the same way against Belgium. They may be playing on the counter-attack in that match. And the idea that Vardy could be running at Vertonghen company, a semi-fit company, and Alderweireld is quite appealing. I mean, I don't think Jamie Vardy did himself too many favours against Costa Rica, but that wasn't really his type of occasion. Belgium might be.
Tunisia, Barry, tell us everything. Barry came in with some notes. He was very proud of himself.
Very intimidated by these notes.
Well, I just knew you wouldn't have done anything on Tunisia. I thought someone better do some homework. Yeah, I won't claim to have seen them play at all.
That's the sort of insight.
That's your first note.
That's my first note.
World Cup Daily every night. This sort of insight. Me and Barry.
Should probably start that again.
No, crack on.
They're managed by a man called Nabil Maloul, a former midfield player. His formations vary, but he's almost certain to play a 5-3-2 against England lineup. You know, very defensively in their opener. A match I would say Tunisia would be more than happy with a point from. And I think this is a massive game for England.
Oh, don't put the
pressure. I really do. Because it's exactly the kind of game, you know, it's like Algeria revisited. It's the game they could draw or lose and immediately put themselves under, you know, tremendous pressure. Tunisia are no world beaters, but they're, you know, they're going to be very defensively obdurate. Unluckily for them, they're missing their star player, he's 27 or 28, Youssef Meskhani. He's out with a knee injury. He's a sort of a very vibrant midfielder, very creative, so that he's a massive loss for them. And the result being their star man is now Sunderland's Wahbi Khazri, who... Well, he's a good, decent winger. He was a decent winger at Sunderland under Allardyce. Then Allardyce left and it all went wrong. He spent last season on loan at Rennes, who have converted him into a striker. And he looks likely to play as a striker for Tunisia. English fans will probably recognise him. He's very good over a dead ball. And decent winger as well, but, you know, as I say, it's likely to start up front. And I don't think England will have it all their own way against Tunisia. I think that could be a really tricky first game if England don't hit the ground running.
Would you be happy, Barry, if a Sunderland player scored the winning goal against England in a group stage match in the World Cup?
Well, I'm not a fan of his because he's one of those players whose woefully bad attitude contributed to Sunderland's demise. I don't think he'll be a Sunderland player next season. You know, I'd imagine he'll be sold on because I presume they can't afford to keep him and he won't want to be there. So, you know, I would laugh if he scored against the winning goal against England, but it doesn't matter whether he's a Sunderland player or a Wren player.
Have you got any more, Barry, on your notes?
Well, Tunisia's the pre... World Cup friendlies, they drew 2-2 with Portugal at the end of last month and played Spain a few days ago and held them scoreless for 84 minutes. So, you know, if they dig in and defend well, teams like this have to be, you know, well-organised, well-drilled. They have to work very, very hard. But, you know, Iceland, Northern Ireland have shown it can be done at major tournaments, small teams doing well against teams that are on paper much, much better than them. So, you know, it'll be an interesting game and I think a very important one for England. Obviously, they're all important, but this one, I think, is... If England won this comfortably, I think it would give them so much confidence that...
Hey, Barry, turn the page and tell us about Panama.
Why don't you tell me about Panama?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the worst 20 seconds of my life was... on a boat just outside of Panama when I was sailing to Colombia, and I felt a little bit seasick, and I just got on this boat trip with 10 people I'd never met, and I tried to go downstairs to go to sleep. It was midnight and we were sailing through the night, and I knew after four steps that I wasn't going to get downstairs to my bed. And as I turned, I tripped and my nose went into the bony knee of a Frenchman, and it started bleeding everywhere. And then I vomited up a linguine bolognese in front of these 10 people I then had to spend 5 days on a boat with. I lay on deck all night, dry retching. And at 4 a.m., some Australians had a fishing line and they caught like some massive fish and then gutted it on deck while I was lying there dry retching. And as the boat sailed from one side to the other, the guts of the fish and the juices started just sort of like dripping down towards my makeshift pillow. I was in the fetal. I just wanted to go back to the bed that I stayed in when I was a child. It was just the worst day of my life. That's what I know about Panama.
Okay.
Barry, if you have any sort of more relevant World Cup information, that would be great. Yeah.
Well, their manager is a Colombian fella called Hernan Gomez, who has a very colourful past. Years and years ago, as manager of Ecuador, he was shot in the leg over a row about team selection. More recently, he was manager of Colombia. He had to quit that because he was he assaulted a woman in a bar. I'm not sure if the woman was his wife or not, but he says it cost him his marriage. So he had to stand down from that job. Now in charge of Panama. He used a 4-4-2 formation throughout qualifying. He's now switched to a 5-4-1. Worked quite well for Panama in a 1-0 defeat against Denmark in March, but then they lost 6-0 to Switzerland a few days later. And his philosophy is sort of keep the ball, attack quickly, concentrate in defence and work hard, you know, which seems kind of obvious. But I think they're prone to awful mistakes and they're not particularly optimistic at all. You know, say Tunisia want to get out of the group for the first time ever in five attempts. Panama just don't want to get hammered. And chances are they will ship a couple of hidings because they're a very old team. They're a slow team. They don't have many standout big name players. You know, they just work hard as a collective, and to be honest, they're very lucky to be at the World Cup at all. You know, they beat Costa Rica, I think, in their last qualifying game, and had to rely on Trinidad and Tobago beating the USA to scrape through on the last day, and that's exactly what happened. Roman Torres was their star of the qualifiers, and I think he goes into this tournament carrying an injury, so he might not be fully fit. And they're the oldest squad at the World Cup, and yeah, in their recent friendlies they drew with Northern Ireland and lost against Norway.
And just pointing you in the direction, Sid Lowe's done a piece, I don't know if you've seen it in the paper today, one of their players, Amílcar Henríquez, who was assassinated last year. And a lot of the squad, you know, saying that he was part of getting to the World Cup was for him. It's a really interesting piece, definitely worth reading. And worth watching a Guardian documentary about Gary Stemple. Sid Lowe's done this as well. Gary's a former Millwall player who moved over to Panama and basically... he became the sort of father figure of Panamanian football. And all, if you ask loads of members of the squad, they say, you know, if it wasn't for Gary, I wouldn't be where I am today. So definitely worth watching that. Let's finish this part with some generic World Cup questions. Finbar says, just how bad will VAR be in the tournament, Dom?
We had to do a sort of predictions for the tournament. You know, what are you dreading most? And the shambles that VAR will be is definitely what I'm dreading most about this. It's not going to work. Then I don't think enough referees who are actually going to be using it over there have used it in the past. It's just got the capacity to be a disaster.
I did read somewhere that the four VAR officials in the headquarters in Moscow will be in full referees kit.
I saw that as well.
Yeah. That's great, isn't it? Andrew says, what should be my beer of choice during the World Cup? I'm thinking of something Russian, but then feel disloyal to England. Maybe an ale or just whatever's on special at the co-op.
Whatever's on special.
There you go. That's how you roll, Barry. Paolo says, if you could take one previous England player and put him in this side, who would be your pick? He says, I'd go for Scholes. And obviously put him on the left-hand side.
Cool, that's a question.
That's a good question, isn't it?
I'm trying to think of a defensive midfielder that would do the job and make life easier from that capacity.
See, I'd go for a number, a playmaker.
What, Hoddle?
That means Hoddle, yeah. I'm thinking Hoddle.
What about Claude Makélélé?
Is he a former England player?
Well, you know, arguably not. But he could do that role, couldn't he?
Yeah, let's go Claude Makélélé.
We'll go Claude. Let's call him Claude Michaels and get him in. And Johnny says, who's Barry supporting in the World Cup?
Nobody, really. I just looking forward to it, generally. My plucky underdog choice is Uruguay, you know, sort of in that second tier of teams who possibly could win it but probably won't. And my new golden boot tip is Timo Werner, who's available at, I think, about 16 to 1. Yeah, and Coutinho 50s and Isco's 50s. I think they're three reasonable shouts for top scorer.
All right. Well, look, that'll do for part two. In part three, some football things have happened since we last did a pod, so we'll talk through them. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Things that have happened since the football season and the pod finished, not necessarily in chronological order, include the following. Pochettino signed a new contract at Spurs. Zidane left Real Madrid. Liverpool signed Fabinho. Frank Lampard took the Derby job. Amazon got some football. The Premier League winter break was announced. Lloris Karius had concussion in the Champions League final, it turns out. Yaya Toure accused Pep of racism. Abramovich put Chelsea's new stadium on hold. Liverpool tried to sign Fakir, but his knee wasn't quite right. Kenny Dalglish was knighted. Defoe got an OBE. Richard Scudamore announced he was stepping down as boss of the Premier League. Aston Villa went into financial meltdown and Harry Kane signed a new contract at Spurs. Barry, do you want to pick one of those? I mean, it's just ludicrous, isn't it? Why did we go on holiday at that time? Why did all this football happen when we went off?
Oh, you left out the League Two playoff final as well.
Oh, yes.
Which we promised to give a minute to.
Yes, congratulations to Coventry City. You're in League One. If no one noticed, they beat Exeter in the playoff final. Not necessarily the biggest of those stories, but worth bringing up.
Yeah, well, I suppose Pochettino and Kane signing new contracts at Spurs, it was excellent news for Spurs fans. I must say the Pochettino one passed me by when it actually happened and I didn't hear about it until Kane signed his. And I'm kind of surprised because I think Poch signed his deal just like 30 seconds before Zinedine Zidane left the Real Madrid job. And you know, the ink was still wet on Poch's contract and he may well have been going, damn it, what have I done? But
not for the first time ever realising that ink rubbers don't work, do they? The blue bit of an eraser you got at school, it only just ripped the paper up, didn't it?
Yeah, especially if you tried to lick it. But you could always use Tippex or something.
That's a good point. Is Pochettino going to Daniel Levy's office with some Tippex? you wonder, Dom, I guess, with that, and the Harry Kane contract, how many, you know, will Daniel Levy's office, apart from the fact that all the players are at the World Cup, be like a sort of dentist waiting room of people saying, I'd like some more money, please?
Well, it's a moment for Tottenham, isn't it? It's the moment they've been waiting for a while, that the new stadium is there, they're ready to go back into it. We need to see evidence that Spurs could, their wage ceiling could be raised so that they can compete with the elite, with the Man Cities, with the Manchester United's. And Kane more than Pochettino, really. I think Pochettino signed it on the, clearly he'd been convinced that Tottenham would change in the way that they approach the finances. Kane doing that is a watershed moment because you're right, the others will follow, but it keeps Tottenham competitive. It keeps them presumably able to resist bids from outside for their best players.
I sort of wonder if part of Harry Kane's deal, he must have said, are we going to...
Well, Pochettino must have been the same.
Yeah. And, you know, there was that... Danny Rose's interview was quoted, wasn't it, about Googling players last year. You imagine they said, well, we have some players that I know who they are.
Well, absolutely. But they've been waiting for that for a while. It's almost as if Tottenham have been in a holding pattern while they've been playing at Wembley. They did brilliantly, I think, to finish in the top four, to finish in the top three. And to guarantee that they will bring Champions League football to the new White Hart Lane next season. But this allows them the finances, the financial fair play, they've got more leeway now. And Levy can be more expansive in how he approaches spending at that club. And you know, Dave Heitner wrote about it in The Guardian. They're suddenly able to compete in a market now, potentially. They can go out and buy players for 60, 70 million, where they previously were only looking at 20, 30 million pound players. And that's a major moment for Daniel Levy.
Did the Zidane decision surprise you?
Not really, just because it's what a brilliant way to go out. He always seems to go out on a high, whether that's headbutting an opponent in a World Cup final from his playing days or, three Champions League successes. He's never not won the Champions League as a manager. It's an amazing record.
Yeah, I mean, Sid called it a couple of days before it happened. I don't think there was any major surprise. It was presented as this awful, shocking announcement, and Florentino Perez was clearly surprised because he looked a bit shell-shocked at the press conference. But most of the journalists who follow Spanish football closely, because Terry Gibson said to us on TalkSport that he wasn't a bit surprised. So, yeah, I think maybe Florentino Perez was the most surprised of all and possibly shouldn't have been. I would imagine managing that Real Madrid team isn't a huge amount of fun, trying to control all those egos. And, it's a good way to go. Always leaves them wanting more, as they say.
I wonder whether they were another club that was celebrating that decision by Zidane might possibly be Chelsea, because there's suddenly an out there for Antonio Conte whereby he walks into another job potentially and they don't have to pay him compensation. They can finally get that ridiculous impasse that club's been at for so long out of the way and move on.
Because that's a weird situation, isn't it, with the Sarri thing, where Napoli have already brought in a manager, but yet they still have to pay compensation for someone who's still there.
It is bizarre, but apparently it's not completely uncommon in Italy that teams can have two managers. No.
And often the one that's been sacked comes back because he's still on the payroll.
Well, the thing about Conte to Real Madrid is, I don't know about anyone else, every part of me would love Arsene Wenger to walk into the Bernabeu and then, you know, win the Champions League and win that, just to see what Arsenal fan TV do and say about that. Could it happen?
It's possible. I think Arsene Wenger will be a decent choice to manage Real, but I've no idea what goes on in the head of Perez, their president.
They're talking about Guti, aren't they? But it almost seems like they're appointing somebody who's only going to be there for the short term.
Well, it's not the right time to take over Real Madrid, is it?
You want to be the next one.
Maybe David Moyes will get it. And they'll just cut to Zidane in the crowd every time an opposition player scores a goal. Talking of managers, Chris Coleman, Barry.
He's off to China.
He's off to Hebei China Fortune, which is where Pellegrino was, yes. Pellegrini. I'll find out where he is, but
Pellegrino. Maurizio Pellegrino. Pellegrino.
Yes.
No?
No, Manuel Pellegrini. No, he's at West Ham.
I resign.
Just when we thought there were no Pellegrins anywhere, that's where he was. He went to West Ham, and Chris Coleman's gone there. What can he take from Sunderland? Everything.
A running jump. Look, he. I don't think he did a very good job at Sunderland. I think he got away with a lot. He seems to have escaped a lot of blame. But, you know, he can go to China, presumably earn a shed load of cash. And it'll be interesting to see how it gets on. You know, it may turn out that taking the Sunderland job wasn't the worst decision he's ever made, but
he'll be managing Jovinio, Lavezzi, Mascherano.
Well, good luck to him. It's certainly a better quality of player than he was managing during his time on Wearside.
We've mentioned Gerrard going to Rangers because fortunately that was something that happened before we stopped doing the pods. But Frank Lampard taking the Derby job is interesting, Dom, isn't it?
Yeah, it's brilliant. A loss to punditry already, it feels. But great news, I think, to get him involved at a club. Derby have, for a long time, they keep making managerial appointments to take them to the next level, to complete the return back to the Premier League. And they forever seem to miss out at the final hurdle. he's going to, I want to say he's going to need time really to get that right, but he won't be given it because Derby are impatient. They're desperate to be back there. Morris, the owner, is he wants the revenues that come with Premier League football, but it's a bit of a risk. But he's got a weight of playing experience. I don't know. He won't know the Championship particularly well.
I think what's interesting about that appointment, well, it is an interesting appointment on its own, but he's taken Jody Morris with him from Chelsea. And Morris seems to have the makings of a very good coach. He's done brilliantly with the Chelsea under-18s. You know, I saw them in the FA Cup final, I think, to beat Arsenal over two legs, Youth Cup final, and they're a cracking team. Now, obviously, he has good players at his disposal, but he seems to be very, very highly regarded as a coach. And now John Terry has rocked up there as well. He's going to be playing for Derby County. Yeah,
I didn't know that. I've seen him on Instagram running up hills.
I think he was on the verge of going. I don't know if he actually inked a contract, but I'm pretty sure.
Oh, yeah, I heard if Curtis Davis wasn't staying, they might get John Terry, but I'm not entirely sure.
That coaching setup you mentioned with Jody Morris and Frank Lampard, that has the sort of makings of a future Chelsea regime to it, doesn't it? I mean, and the guys that when they left, when Morris was confirmed to be leaving for Derby, that within Chelsea, that, you know, the sentiment was very much, we'll see you again, you know, good luck, go, and this is the next stage of your apprenticeship almost. And I think he'll do a good job. I agree with you, Barry. He's a good coach. He's a good developing talent.
Which is a harder, riskier decision, Lampard's or Gerrard's?
Gerrard's. Definitely. Oof.
I still don't understand. I mean, like, I almost think it's incredibly brave, given that he could just have watched Klopp for as long as he liked and learn.
It is. That's exactly what it is. Brave.
Some would say foolhardy. I go with brave.
Okay. Amazon got some football. They'll get the whole of match day of fixtures on Boxing Day 2019 and one more midweek match day fixture list. So these are the rights that start not next season, but the season after that. Is this a watershed moment, Dom? Are people... it's funny, you sort of think most fans would just like it all to be on one channel so they could just get that channel and have it all, but competition is competition.
It's not how it works anymore, unfortunately, is it? It's sort of been threatened for a while. Amazon and Netflix was the other one mentioned, wasn't it? Buying into Premier League rights, but... For the average fan, it's just another platform that you've got to pay money to watch football on, which, you know, is starting to get... I mean, we've got three now, haven't we? And there'll be more in the future as well. It's not a great situation.
Agree?
Yeah, I mean, look, I used to get all the Premier League for whatever, 40 quid a month. I currently pay over 100. I draw the line of paying a third subscription. You know, maybe what you can do is sign up for the Amazon Prime 30-day free trial and then just remember to cancel.
Do you know what? I was buying a mousetrap on Amazon yesterday, and I accidentally, because it's quite hard not to sign up for Amazon Prime just because the way they've got the buttons, and I accidentally signed up for it. And then I was furious about it, so I unsigned straight away. I did get free delivery of my mousetraps. And humane mousetraps, I'd like to point out. But it means I've done my Prime thing, so I can't do it again. Maybe a bit like carpooling. You just need to get one of you, you get three of you together, and one gets Sky, and one gets BT, and one gets Amazon Prime. Yeah, and then you can just get door keys.
Were you... do you have a rodent infestation, or were you buying the game with the ball and the ramp and the ladder and the pocket?
Or the long-running West Ham player.
He never jumped in. He never landed in the bath, did he? That was the issue with Mousetrap, that when the springboard diver, he would always miss the bucket, and that's when he'd had to press the thing. Anyway, I have two mice, and that's too many. One is fine, and there's a lot of mouse poo in the pull-out cupboard. Yeah, so an issue for me. The winter break, on the other hand, we think this is a good idea. It's sadly not a winter break for broadcasters, because they're going to have half the game.
Yeah.
Half the game's one weekend. Half the teams get one Saturday off and half the teams get another Saturday off. This will mean that we will win the Euros in 2020, Dom.
Yeah. it's great. It's in the bag, isn't it? Fantastic. It's quite cleverly done. It shouldn't impinge upon people who've been insistent that we shouldn't have one. There's a lot of sense to it, the number of games that people play these days. So, yeah, let's give it a go. Let's see how it works. It should be fine.
Loris Karius had concussion, Barry, in the Champions League final. He went to Boston, I think it was, to find out that he had concussion.
Mm.
What do we think about this?
Well, I saw a lot of cynics suggesting that, you know, the hospital he went to is connected to John W. Henry, who's the owner of Liverpool, and that, you know, it's them trying to make excuses so that his value doesn't decrease. Look, the allegation being that some doctors lied about his condition. Now, that's a pretty stupid thing to say. It's probably a libelous allegation. He had concussion. The concussion may not necessarily have contributed to his errors. We'll never know. But, yeah, I think it's an indisputable fact. He was concussed in that challenge where, somebody shoved... Someone shoved Ramos and Ramos caught him on the head with his elbow. So
Ramos innocent in all of this.
Oh, of course, yes. I suppose it doesn't make any difference. You know, Liverpool still lost. He still made two big blunders. But, yeah, the fact that he was concussed is something we need to consider.
Liverpool have been signing some players, Dom. Not Nabil Fekir, though, which is a weird situation where it seems to have got to the stage where he'd had a squad number. You know, it was that done. By all accounts, Leon, Philippe Auclair was telling us, Barry, wasn't it, that Leon's owner is the sort of Daniel Levy of Ligue 1.
And Bolas, yeah, yeah.
And so that's why, one of the reasons why it hasn't happened.
I wonder whether it could be revived. I mean, it's the type of thing that I think there were some suggestions in France that it's to do with tax years, whether the sale would benefit Lyon going into next tax year and allow them to compete more in the transfer market as a result. I don't know. We'll see. It's the type of deal, though, that is revived. We saw, I mean, Liverpool's pursuit of Van Dijk, let's go back, and that dragged on for 6 months, but it was eventually completed. And Fekir's a talent. He's a fantastic playmaker, attacking player, and it would add to Liverpool's already impressive armoury. Fabinho is going to be a good signing as well. He did a fantastic job at Monaco, and will add to the bit of strength into central midfield for them.
Yeah, I mean, the World Cup's still to come, and I'm excited about that. But with what Spurs are doing and what Liverpool are doing, it makes the Premier League look quite interesting next season. Kenny Dalglish on Liverpool was knighted. I don't think anyone would have anything but positive things to say about what Kenny Dalglish did, not only as a player, as a manager, but over Hillsborough and how the support he gave those families at that time was pretty incredible, Barry.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been incredibly harrowing for him and everyone at Liverpool, obviously, but he conducted himself in the... It's difficult to know how he could have conducted himself any better. And I mean, I think the honours system is a crock anyway, but if anyone is worthy of a knighthood, it's him, you know. You see some of the people who get them, you know. I think the chairman of one of these rail companies who's currently in absolute shambles, he's got one as well, you know, which shows you the kind of value you can place on a knighthood. But yeah, I wouldn't begrudge Kenny Dalglish one, but you know, doesn't interest me that stuff.
Would you accept one?
No.
Sir Barry?
No. I'm not sure if... Oh, I think I can get one. I think Bob Geldof has one, hasn't he? And Terry Wogan had one.
Yeah.
But
you'd be allowed one, Barry.
Yeah, I don't want one.
Just, is that absolute for the record? Should we send that note to the Palace?
I don't think it's ever going to be an issue. I don't think the issue of me arising is ever going to arise, Sir Barry. But I wouldn't want one. Congratulations to Sir Kenny.
Absolutely. In the final of the CONEFA World Football Cup, which we covered with Paul Watson, Carpatalia beat Northern Cyprus 3-2 on penalties. Carpatalia represent ethnic Hungarians living in Ukraine. Only joined the team list at the last minute, replacing Felvidek. So much like Denmark in 92.
They were on the beach.
They were on the beach, but it was fine. And that'll do for today's Football Weekly. The World Cup pods, World Cup Football Daily begins on Thursday. Barry in the studio, yes?
I think so, yep.
Don, we're going to ring you up whenever we want.
Please do.
Have a great time in Russia.
Thank you very much.
And we'll speak to you on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.